Chief.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Barks. Ladies and gentlemen, brethren and sistern. It's always a pleasure to come back here. I have been coming down to this seminary for meetings for over 25 years, probably until I retired, probably never more than a week apart. So it's fun to be back here again, and I have many, many memories going back a long, long way. During my so-called active career, I was always working on Chemnitz. I'd been given various assignments to translate him, and it came to be a sort of an hour of sanity in an otherwise somewhat loony world. My secretary down at the office, Miss Jean Bittner, sometimes her name is spelled Butner, but her real name is Bittner. She comes from over in southern Illinois, and she preceded me. She worked for Synod before I came. She worked in the mission department. She worked for Walbrecht. Then she worked for Harms, and then she worked for me. And I used to kid her and say, you ought to write your memoirs and entitle them My 7 Years in a Nut House. She's now got about 30 years, and she still has some sanity left, and I guess I do, and I credit it partly to the good Lord and partly to the fact that I was able to spend an hour every day of my life with a very wise, bright, sound, orthodox, biblical, confessional Lutheran by the name of Martin Chemnitz. Born one day apart from Luther, that is, birthday-wise, and both of them named after that great soldier, St. Martin. This year, as you know, we're celebrating his 400th anniversary of Martin Chemnitz's demise in his 64th year. A few words about the man himself, because I think he will interest you. There came to be a point somewhere in the history of Lutheranism, I think a little bit later than Chemnitz's time, in which they forbade the children of the sons of the nobility to go into the ministry. They had to be the sons of common people. It probably was I never found out the reason for this, but it probably was due to the fact that they didn't want any more Medicis and people of that kind in the Lutheran ministry. And it's from the very beginning, with Luther himself being the son of a coal miner, and as you know, not a particularly reverent one, we have in Martin Chemnitz, the second Martin, the son of a wool merchant, who married a woman who was known largely for the fact that she was as tight as the bark on a tree, and had an older son by the name of Paul, who did not recognize Martin's talents and thought the best thing could be done with that whippersnapper was to keep him home working in the wool factory. So between a mother who wouldn't spend any money and a brother who wanted to keep him at home, he had a difficult time getting an education, something that some of you will relate to very well, unless you happen to be the sons of nobility. And I don't think I think that idea has carried on down through the history of Lutheranism. He also not only was a poor boy brought up in the common herd of mankind, but he received a very general education in several different institutions, going in many parts of Germany. And as one looks at it, I'm sure as Dr. Schmelder, for example, would look at his transcript, he probably would say, you have not received a particularly good schooling. His real education began when he was given an opportunity to be the librarian at the newly formed Lutheran University at Königsberg in Prussia, now part of Poland. I won't make any comments about that. And he was the librarian. he sat in that library and read books. A typical library. I don't suppose anybody used it. And so he had ample time to sit there, and he apparently just went right straight through them from A to Z and read all of Luther, and then he read the Church Fathers, and he made notations and kept filing stuff and putting things away. And when I first translated him, I thought I had for example, in the work on the Two Natures of Christ, there's one chapter that has 300 footnotes, citations from Church Fathers. And I thought, well, that probably exhausts his list. When I got into other later translations, I thought, I'll go back and look at these same things, and they'll all be there. Not one of them was there. He has thousands of citations from Church Fathers. Now, Chemnitz, with this rather, well, I don't know what you want to call it, sort of a generalization background, he wasn't even sure if he wanted to go into ministry, and this, it's not right to call it ecumenical education, spotty education maybe, gets there to Königsberg, and he finds a duke there who was a convert from Catholicism. In fact, he'd been the Grand Master of the Teutonic Knights. He was converted to Lutheranism, perhaps Christianity too, by a man with the very interesting name of Andreas Osiander. And about the time Chemnitz arrived there in this exalted position as librarian, Osiander gets up and starts agitating and pontificating in favor of an error that came to be known strangely as Osianderianism. The first thing you know, the theological faculty is jumping all over poor Andreas. And there was this fellow, one of the head men, Joachim Merlin, who said to young Chemnitz, "You are a bright young man. I have selected you to refute him." And so Chemnitz's career was launched. He had not even received basically a theological education at the time. He was involved, that's the man. Now, part two, the times. Luther departed this life in 1546. Already within his lifetime, there were beginning to be problems. Those of you that have read Theodor Emanuel Schmauck and other such literature will recall that Melanchthon was playing a double game and horsing around and carrying on his own little negotiations as early as 1530 at the time they were sitting there drawing up the Augsburg Confession. There was also a fellow by the name of John Agricola of Eisleben, who was the father of the antinomian controversy, later dealt with in the Formula of Concord under the general heading of the third use of the law. Eisleben was in quiet and pious revolt as even earlier than Melanchthon was, agitating that the law had no role in the life of a Christian. While Chemnitz was sitting over in the corner of the faculty meetings while the faculty were debating Osianderianism, there was a fellow on the faculty named Staphylus, who was born in Catholicism. I think he was an Austrian. And Staphylus had converted to Lutheranism, and shortly after the Osiandrian controversy blew up, Staphylus reverted to Rome. He defected, or as we would say in more modern times, he apostatized. And he said, "I sat there on that faculty for years, and nobody ever knew what I thought. I always governed my language in such a way that nobody was ever quite sure where I stood on anything." Sounds familiar, doesn't it? So what I'm saying is that our young friend, even before in what you might call his pre-theological period, was learning what was going on in the church. Now, our friend Martin Luther died in 1546, and if I'm not mistaken, Charles V stood at his grave with his Spanish soldiers in 1547, and they said, "Dig him up." And there began the Counter-Reformation, which lasted all through the life of Martin Chemnitz, all through several other generations, and was not settled until the year 1648 with the Peace of Westphalia, the end of the 30 Years' War, taking the life of one-third of all of the people in Europe. So Chemnitz lived at an interesting time, and during these years, after Luther died, you had a complete collapse of leadership. You had this Melanchthon, a wishy-washy, wimpy sort of a fellow, a good theologian, a very bright man, and probably more often right than his opponents give him credit for being, but definitely wrong on certain points. But you see, the problem was with Melanchthon, and I'm always kind of trying to be existential about this, because these things always have counterparts or parallels in our modern age. Martin Luther, to us, is the greatest guy that ever lived. But when he taught at Wittenberg, he would have about 400 students. That's not bad. You'd be happy to have that. But all sitting in his class. But Melanchthon would have 800 students. And only a third of the classes he taught were in theology. He taught philosophy, he taught medicine, he taught scientific courses. And as a result of his teaching, you had not only preachers, and he himself was never ordained. He was sort of the forerunner of the Lutheran Layman's League, with a sort of an anti-clerical bent. But he had doctors and lawyers and politicians and government people, professors, all kinds of people who looked up to him. And they were all over Europe. They were in England, they were in Scandinavia, they were in Eastern Europe. Dr. Daniel can tell you all about them over in the Slavic countries. And this boy had influence. And he didn't really like theological controversy, but everybody else did. It was not a time to be a peaceful man. Well, so here you have Lutheranism, the great lion lying in his grave, Melanchthon standing his sword in his hands, the Counter-Reformation starting, the interim starting. Melanchthon signed the interim, John Bugenhagen signed the interim, all kinds of interesting people. On the other hand, you had, for example, Luther standing up at Smalcald, confessing the faith, the article on the Pope, the Antichrist. And who stood next to him? On one side stood the famous John Agricola, the father of the antinomian movement, and the other side of him stood Andrew Osiander. So you had a mixed bag of theological confusion and uncertainty. And paranoia. And nobody knew when those bloody Spaniards were going to come back. And of course, Charles V, as you know, was more Catholic than the Pope. In fact, he invaded Rome and said, "We've got to teach you a few things too." Which he did. The only thing, really, if you want the truth of it, and I hate to say this in front of historians, but you got the rest of the school year to reject it. The two guys that should have been given the honorary doctorates in that era were Francis I of France and Suleiman the Magnificent, the grand leader of the Turks. Because it is only because of them that old Charles V could not come in and say, "We're going to pound you guys back into line where you belong." But the Lutherans, as our friend Chemnitz demonstrates, rejoiced in their freedom in the gospel, rejoiced in the political freedom made possible by Suleiman and Francis, in order to go at each other. And so you have this whole series of conflicts, I've mentioned several and there are many more, that finally came to ultimate fruition where Jacob Andrea, who I believe was ordained into the ministry at the age of 17 and was the only minister in his town, and what town was it, Stuttgart or someplace like that, he was the only Lutheran minister in town who stayed when the interim began. All the rest fled. But old Andrea, just a young kid after all, too dumb to know that he was in trouble. Anyway, he stayed. And he tried to put these poor Lutherans together. See, they were divided politically by the territorial churches. They were divided theologically. By the time Chemnitz is really into the saddle, you have the Sacramentarian, the crypto-Calvinistic controversy raging at Wittenberg, the citadel of Lutheranism, and the leader of it was a doctor, an MD, who happened by just the sheerest fluke to be the son-in-law of Philip Melanchthon. So this was, you have to say for Chemnitz, the times were interesting. They didn't suffer from too much boredom. But all of this stuff was going on while this young man began his theological studies. I think it did him good, because after being involved in an attack on Calvinism on the Lord's Supper and in being involved with Osiander, he left his Kashi job as a librarian and journeyed to Wittenberg, where Melanchthon said to him, "You look hungry, young man." And he probably was. "I've got a spot at my table. Come on and live in my house." So Melanchthon became a house guest of, Chemnitz became a house guest of Melanchthon. Pretty soon, Melanchthon, having stood so firmly on the Osiandrian error, which Melanchthon also stood against. Melanchthon deserves a lot of credit in Lutheranism for the stress he made on the doctrine of the imputed righteousness of Christ as compared to the inherent righteousness which Osiander was harping about, and also for the doctrine of the vicarious atonement. And he improved on Luther in the concept of the distinction of law and gospel. So the church owes some things to Melanchthon. Next thing you know, Chemnitz is in there lecturing. And an amusing thing, of course, he was chosen to lecture on Melanchthon's Loci Communes. It would be like Francis Pieper hiring some young guy like Theodore Nickel or somebody of that sort and say, "We're going to teach you, have you teach dogmatics here, and the text you're going to use by purest accident is Pieper's Dogmatics." Anyway, Chemnitz stuck with that for about a year, but then I think really the old common clay and the desire to get back into the life of the church had a great influence. And maybe what he saw, maybe he saw things coming over the horizon. I don't know. Anyway, after really a very short stint at Wittenberg, he laid down the office of theological professor and went up into North Germany to Braunschweig or Brunswick, where he became an assistant superintendent. Now, I'm not going to go into a lot of this talk, except to say that from that day on, Martin Chemnitz, at the age, he was about 24 years old at the time, 34 years old at the time, began his work as a church superintendent with the task of Lutheranizing this territory, developing a church order for it in the way of bylaws. It was interesting to listen to Dr. Hopman's comments this morning when he introduced those candidates. It sounded just exactly like somebody being sworn into office under the rubrics of the County of St. Louis and the State of Missouri and the United States of America. Everybody was in it except God. And we had the Senate in there. I mean, but that's the kind of stuff they did. These fellas had to be certified, they had to be authorized, they had to be approved, they had to be rite vocatus, and all the rest. So, here comes our boy Martin. Now, we come to the Dr. Bartha's leaving. First in war, first in peace, and first to the door. Now, how did Chemnitz operate with all this error in which the church was swimming at the time? Of course, his ultimate end, the bottom line of it, of course, was the formula of Concord. And you must understand, brethren, that the formula of Concord, like all formulas of Concord, and even sometimes formulas of discord, that was not universally approved. There were those on the left who still had a good dose of Calvinism in them, and they didn't like that doctrine of ubiquity. And there were those on the right who said it's entirely too compromising. We're giving away the whole ball game here. And then there were those who said, I don't like Chemnitz. And there were those who didn't like somebody else. So, of course, it wasn't totally accepted, but it was the best piece of work that could have been produced at the time. It saved Lutheranism as an entity. We're really in a period when we're bridging over from Lutheranism as a confessional movement to Lutheranism as an established institutional church. And I think Chemnitz deserves a lot of credit for this. Now, how did he operate in the refutation of error or in dealing with error? First of all, any amount that you would read on him, you could read very little. He defines terms. He says the point at issue is not this, it is not that, it is not this, it is not that, it is this. And it was extremely helpful in diverting, in getting people's attention riveted on the right point. Now, I'm talking mostly to you students. The faculty is sort of beyond redemption. But they've got hardening of the concepts. But you are the future leaders of this church. We have here future good pastors of important and good congregations. We have district presidents. We've got some theologians. We may even, heaven forbid, have a synodical president sitting in the audience here. If you're going to, and you're going to be involved in conflict, in controversy. You're going to be involved in doctrinal controversy. My heavens, with the Mormons on the march, the Jehovah's Witnesses in full retreat, and a revived Catholicism and Lutheran unity and all the other things that are going on, if you have any cerebration at all, at any level, you are going to be involved in dealing with error. And you can deal with it well, or you can deal with it just plain awful. I had a predecessor, a sweet old guy, served 41 years. He shouldn't have stayed that long in the ministry. And every time he'd have a funeral, he would find out what the prevalent denomination of the visiting mourners was. And if he found it was Methodist, for example, he saw to it that his sermon covered several well-directed blasts at the Methodists. Now, I know he had the feeling that he testified to the truth, but it's also very true that he did not gain a great many Methodists. I mean, that was one way of dealing with error. But Chemnitz, for example, was very precise on this. You must define terms. Let's not talk about the wrong issue. Let's talk about the pointed issue, something we could learn. Related to this, he even included in a confessional document, one of the forerunners of the Book of Concord, called the Corpus Julianum, which was the confessional statement for the Duchy of Braunschweig. He included a book by a famous and notable Lutheran minister named Urbanus Regius, who wrote a treatise on the art of talking precisely. talking, writing, and speaking precisely, and he put it in the confession. One wishes that even some things in our confessions were a little bit clearer. But at any rate, this is how important Chemnitz considered this to be. Another thing that these boys agreed on, at least in the formula of Concord, and I find it in all of Chemnitz's major public writings, like his Two Natures of Christ. I was out at a Reformed Episcopal Seminary the other day in Pennsylvania, where they have in their creedal statement, "We reject the idea that the body and blood of Christ are present in the Lord's Supper." That's how they are. And one of the professors came up to me and he said, "I have just finished reading Chemnitz's work on the Two Natures of Christ." He said, "It's a magnificent book." He said, "I have never read anything so fine in my life on Christology." Although the book was actually written to refute the crypto-Calvinists on the Lord's Supper at Wittenberg. In other words, Chemnitz did not spend his time naming names, blasting people, attacking their character, misjudging their words, misinterpreting what they said. He dealt with the, let's keep it on a theological level. For example, as you well know, Melanchthon, who was behind virtually every controversy settled by the Formula of Concord, and in many ways was a kind of a bête noir in Lutheranism. He was a great man and many good things, lots of friends, but he really was a problem. And yet, his name is never mentioned. No other Lutheran's name is ever mentioned in the Formula of Concord. Only Martin Luther. The churches adhering to the Augsburg Confession adhered to Martin Luther. He was their church father. Then Chemnitz always, in every place, comes with a concept of we must stick with Scripture. He'll quote fathers until it bores you. And yet, after all these fellows have been listened to, the all-important decisive thing is, what does the Scripture say? And this is backed. This was not based purely on his interpretation of the St. James Bible. This was based on the Hebrew, the Greek, in the Old Testament, the Septuagint, as well as the Hebrew, and a good use of classical Greek in his, and the classic Cicero and so on. He shows a good knowledge of these people. But the Scripture is the basis. I don't recall Chemnitz ever using the word sola scriptura, and I'm still trying to find who it was that coined the term sola gratia, sola fide, and sola scriptura. I've never been able to find the person where those words are written that way. But Chemnitz is sure a sola scriptura theologian. Then he had the ability to say at certain points, which is also a theological talent, to say, "I don't know." Now, I admit that's a hard thing for a German Lutheran theologian to say. "I don't know." Practice it each morning. But, for example, Luther and Brenz got themselves into the ubiquity problem, and the Reformed were poo-pooing them and picking on them. "You mean to say that Christ's body and blood, Christ is present in that pile of horse manure and that type?" That was the level at which the theological discussion was carried on. And Chemnitz said, "Look, Christ is present where the Scripture says he is. He's present, as the Scripture says, in the church and in the hearts of the believers. Now take it, and that's the end of it." And he said, over and over again, he says, "We will leave this question to the Heavenly Academy. We will answer this question in heaven, because we can't answer it here." It's a very good and rather un-Lutheran statement. He has a, coming into the matter of names. For example, he didn't quite agree with John Brenz but he never picks on him, never touches him in a negative way. In his Loci Theologici, he has a section on a chapter. It comes under the section on the law, the locus on the law, in which he has a section entitled Infelicitous and Unfortunate Statements of Luther. Luther made a lot of statements on the law, which were grabbed up by the Catholics. On the one hand, that's heresy, and on the other hand, by the antinomians, who said, there, see, Luther says it, no law. And Chemnitz wends his way through these things, taking them statement by statement. He says, you got to read them in the context. You haven't translated them correctly. You don't understand what he's talking about here. Never once does he say he's wrong. But on the other hand, he doesn't sit there and die for a lost cause, in the sense of whatever Luther said had to be right, even though it contradicts what he says over here. He had a way. For example, if you are sharp on your knowledge of the confessions, you will recall that the formula of Concord is signed by six men, the four who actually did the work, Chemnitz, Andrea, Selnecker, and Chytraeus. But the two other names mentioned, who came in only on the last couple of readings, one is a fellow by the name of Kerner, or Corner, and the other was a fellow by the name of Andrew Musculus, a very revered and an old man. And Andrew Musculus had gotten himself tied up on something and written a paper which really wasn't very good. In fact, he fell into error along with all these other guys. This was brought to Chemnitz, and he looked at it and said, this can't do. So he sat down, wrote a treatise refuting it. But by the time he got finished, and without any consultation with Musculus, Musculus had been brought to see the error of his ways by somebody else, and he said, man, I didn't realize I was wrong. And he corrected it. Now, Chemnitz did not follow the procedure of some modern theologians and journalists and say, we got to give this guy that kick in the pants that he deserves. He quietly shelved the paper. And when everybody was dead, Musculus and Chemnitz and everybody else, Polycarp Leiser, who edited Chemnitz's work, includes it. He says, this is a very good treatise, wonderful thing. And again, Musculus, there's not a line in it that attacks him as a person or his character or his judgment or anything else. Just unfortunate. Chemnitz had a hierarchy of attack. If you would read his Examen Concilii Tridentini, and I'm just right now in the process of translating a little treatise that he wrote before. I think it was kind of a warm-up for the examen. He is very hard on the Pope. The Pope is the whore of Babylon. He is the Antichrist, Antichristissimus. He is everything that Luther says about him, but Chemnitz does not call him by animal names. He's not a jackass or a monkey, or that kind of thing. But he gives him these biblical names right out of the book of Revelation. Well, the second hierarchy in the level is the enthusiasts. Not a great deal is said about them. But when you get into his Loci Theologici, and he talks about baptism, and he talks about the doctrine of the ministry, and the doctrine of the church, and things of that kind, they are just plain out of line. And they are also treated as intruders, interlopers, improperly educated, ignoramuses, that type of thing. The third in the hierarchy is the Reformed. He still occasionally here will mention names. And he really goes after them. And the fourth is fellow Lutherans. He does not mention names of fellow Lutherans, even crypto-Calvinists. Only those that are so far out, like Staphylus and some, they will be mentioned. But he seems to have the very definite idea that these people do adhere to the Augsburg Confession, and we hope to regain them, and not everybody in Saxony is a heretic, and therefore maybe we ought to deal with them strictly on the issues and not open ourselves to the attack of having engaged in personalities. Finally, I think it has to be said, and this may be a subjective judgment, but I think part of Chemnitz's greatness and part of the fact that Chemnitz was able to make such a contribution to Lutheranism, and I call him, without having been contradicted, the father of normative Lutheranism. And that is that Chemnitz, I think, had a kind of a theological instinct. He could kind of tell what was right and what was wrong. And I say to you as future ministers, try to develop that. Don't be the first one to shoot from the hip. Don't be the last one to jump on the wagon. But try to develop an ability to think, to reason, to analyze, to read, mark, learn, and inwardly digest words which were written by Cranmer, incidentally, and try to pick out what's good and what's bad, and not immediately climb all over something or climb onto something. We've had, I think, in the Missouri Synod, in the past generation, an attitude, if it's new, it's got to be right. And if it's old, it's got to be wrong. Both are wrong. If it's new, it may be right. If it's old, it possibly is wrong. But Chemnitz's general attitude was, if it's old, we better look at it because it's been around for a long time, and maybe there was good reason for it being around for a long time. I think that the reason that Chemnitz came through so well is that on virtually every issue, whether it was Osiander or Aesculapius or Melanchthon or you name it, old Martin comes through right. And I won't go into it now because the time is going, but simply to say he did not do this on the basis of compromise. He did not do this on the basis of straw votes or surveys. He did it on the basis of Scripture and the basis of the history of the church, his knowledge of Luther and so on, and on the basis of being a person who could deal with issues. He didn't irritate and aggravate by a lot of unnecessary polemics and things of this kind, but just stuck to the issues. Now, Dr. Barth, if there are any questions, arguments, disagreements, whatever, now's your opportunity until you tell them that it's time for lunch or whatever.
All right. Comments and questions, please. Faculty's mad. They're not going to respond because of what you said.
And I don't blame them. I don't blame them.
Yes, please.
I got involved in it because one of the few talents I have, and those who know me will totally agree with that statement, but from my high school days, I was always pretty good in Latin and liked it. I liked languages and translation and so on. And I went on, took my degree in it. I wrote my doctorate in St. Jerome so that I had some contact with the Latin of the church and the that kind of thing. And first I was asked by an uncle of mine to pick up a piece that had been translated by a lay Latin scholar. He was a head of a department at one of the Lutheran colleges. But when he came to Peter Lombard, he translated his name Lombardi. I think he was thinking of Vince Lombardi. And so at this point, my uncle said, well, apparently there's a few theological gaps in this guy's education. We'll ask little Jack to go over it, which I did, and that came out in the work called The Doctrine of Man in Gerhard and Chemnitz. That was my first exposure. Then I was asked by CPH to do various translation jobs, all of which have now been completed with the completion of the Loci Theologici, which the good Lord and CPH willing will see the light of day, I hope, in 1987. In some form, it went 3,000 pages, and it's really a magnificent work. When you get it, I suggest you buy it. Hold the meals, hold the sleep, hold the house calls, hold the funerals and the weddings, and sit down and read it. But it really is fun. I enjoyed it very much. The way in which what I would like to see done, now we've got a fellow like Bob Kolb, and we've got David Daniel, and we've got young fellas, and it's so nice to see young fellas in this, who are doing a great deal to dig, and if I've missed any, it's not intentional, who are working in the area of 16th and 17th century Lutheranism in an area that really was neglected for a long, long time. Everybody studied Luther. Then everybody studied only the young Luther. It'll interest you to know that Chemnitz, most of Chemnitz quotations are from the old and mature Luther, the commentary on Galatians and so on. And this class I taught here last summer was so fun. I'm not hinting or anything, but it would be fun to be on his faculty and have a seminar like that going all the time of bright, interested fellows. We could, with term papers and projects and study and digging around, we could do all kinds of stuff. It can't be done by one or two people. Now, for example, there's a young professor up at Luther Seminary, ALC, heaven forbid. But nevertheless, can anything good come out of Nazareth? This guy has produced a book on the antinomian controversy, Agricola and Luther's great disputationes against Agricola, something that never got into the American edition of Luther's works. And this should be a fascinating book and study, and it's something totally new that nobody has dug into at all. I just came across it when Chemnitz starts digging on it under the third use of the law. So I think there's a lot of young guys that could become very interested in this, and I'm sure there are many of them here and out in the ministry. Some of this can be done by a fella sitting in a parish. You don't have to be a prof or a CHI man or some kind of a guy on a pedestal. What you need to be is a guy that can sit on a chair and open a book and translate. The Latin dictionary helps. And the same applies with German. There's tons of stuff in German that I'm not capable of digging up, but I'm sure there are people who are, and we've got a great contribution to make. So there's a great future in this area.
Maybe you want to... Yes, please, Dr. Spencer.
Did Martin Chemnitz ever comment on Martin Luther's way of handling disputes? As far as you know, it seems to be a little different.
In the years of Chemnitz flourishing from 1554 to 1585, Martin Luther is almost God. He is inerrant. I have never seen one criticism of Luther in the writings of Martin Chemnitz. Now, I know he didn't agree with him always. He writes this stuff on these infelicitous statements. But it is absolutely verboten to criticize him. But it is interesting I was asked up at Fort Wayne some years ago to write a paper on the use of the church fathers in the formula of Concord. It was a rather barren subject because there are not nearly as many quotations from the fathers as most of us thought, except Augustine and except in that catalog of testimonies at the end of the formula. But the father they quote all the time is Martin J. Luther. All the time. He's the father. And they quote, as I was saying, these mature, solid, dispassionate works. They're not talking about Hans Wurst. They're not talking about the Pope being a jackass and all this stuff. But when they quote Luther, it's the commentary on Galatians. Just go through it yourself. Look at the Formula of Concord and watch the Luther quotes. A lot of quotes from the small called articles. A lot of quotes from very formal and official works of Luther. And I kind of, and for example, Luther's infelicitous statements on the canon, some of which, the opinion on which Chemnitz shares in the Examen Concilii. But by the time you get to John Gerhard, those statements again are put under the heading sort of infelicitous statements. They, where Luther would make sort of radical statements within a certain context in which he probably was totally right, but where it was taken out of context and used against him and against Lutheranism, the Lutherans kind of quietly shelved it. And I don't think Chemnitz would ever say that Luther was too hard on the Pope, say, or later on the in his treatises on the Lord's Supper, which are quoted all the time in the formula. But rather, they would reiterate the very best part of what he writes and make that their confessional basis.
I'm very grateful to you, and thank you so much.
Pleasure.
For being with us again. Look
nice
forward to
you.
Your next appearance.